So we are starting a new series tonight. We're going to start a series on the life of Joseph. This is Joseph from the Old Testament. And I'm excited for this study for many reasons. Really, what this is coming from, honestly, this study is just going to be an overflow from my sermon preparation. The last sermon I did was about Joseph and Daniel and some of their similarities. And I said this on Sunday, but it's funny, so far preaching, I've come to see that one of the harder things is deciding, like, what are you not going to say? You know, you spend so much time studying, learning, studying, and then you get 30 or 35 minutes to try to put that all together. So there's so much in Joseph's story that by the end of my prep, I basically had studied his whole life, and I figured, we need to share these things. So we're going to do a study on the life of Joseph. It'll be several weeks. We'll walk through it together. If all you know about Joseph so far is that he's the guy with the coat of many colors, you're missing out, because his story is incredible, and it's going to be real fun to walk through it. Joseph's story is one of these stories, personally, that I feel like it just makes you fall in love with the Bible. It's not a very complicated story, in as you read it, even a child could follow it, yet it is complex as you see God working through this. There's lots of challenges that Joseph has to overcome, and God's working the whole time. I call it, it's like one of the best dramas there are, right? You might think, what's it like, The Real Housewives or something. I'm telling you, this is a way better drama, okay? Another thing I love about this particular study on Joseph is it helps us to see. Really, it helps us to fall in love with Scripture and then also fall in love with the God of Scripture. And the reason I say that is, as you see Joseph's story and we see how God is working through the kind of worst moments of Joseph's life, it's amazing when you come to realize that is the same God that we worship. The same God who was working with Joseph is the same God who we worship. And just how God works through the trials and tribulations that Joseph goes through, that's what he does in our lives. He works through our trials and our tribulations, and you might think you're not worthy, you might think you've got a dysfunctional family. I promise you, after today, you're going to realize it's not that bad. But it's amazing to see, and it helps you fall in love with God. Here's my goal for this study. I want to help, we're going to take a different kind of angle as we look through Joseph's life, and what I want us to I'm going to unpack little by little, is ask the question, why is this story in Genesis? Why is Joseph's story in Genesis? And why does it get so much space in the book of Genesis? And I talked about this on Sunday, if you were here. Genesis is 50 chapters, and it's a long book. It's one of the longest books in the Bible. And it's got all these important things, like the creation of the world. God creates the entire world, and that gets one chapter. And then we say, okay, well, how long was everything good with Adam and Eve? One chapter. And then you get the fall of man in chapter 3, a single chapter, where everything goes wrong. And then you got other important events like Noah's Ark and the flood, and those get a little bit more time. But then you get to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Joseph, Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And they all get more time, but Joseph's story gets more space in the book of Genesis than any of theirs. So it's kind of an interesting thought. He's not even one of the patriarchs, and he gets a quarter of the book. So I want to start unpacking a little bit why that is. Something else I want us to see as we go through this study is I want to change the way you view Joseph's story a little bit. I don't want us to view it anymore like the end of the book of Genesis, right? It comes at the end. I don't want to view it just like it's the end. I actually want to view it like it's the culmination of the book. The book's going in a direction, and this is where it's going. One of the guys I was reading, he calls Joseph's story the anticipatory fulfillment of the book of Genesis. And what he means is fulfillment in the sense that there's many themes that we're going to talk through tonight that are opened up in the book of Genesis. And those themes run throughout the whole book, and you get to Joseph's story, and they're partially fulfilled in his story. And I say partially on purpose, because if everything was fulfilled in Joseph's story, we wouldn't have the rest of the Bible, and we wouldn't have a need for Jesus. So it's not completely fulfilled. We need Jesus and we need the rest of the Bible to understand that. But it's an anticipatory fulfillment. Things start working together in Joseph's story that give us foreshadowing and hints of things to come. So we're going to view this as the fulfillment or the culmination of the book, not just the end. Another way we could say it is Joseph's story, it's the denouement of Genesis. Does anybody know what that denouement? Tying up of loose ends. Denouement, it's a French word to untie. You're untying a knot, or you're untying loose ends. It's a word that's used to describe movies or narratives or stories. There's a portion of that story towards the end where the loose ends all come together. So I like, for me, this thinks about, it makes me think of like a mystery novel, like Agatha Christie mystery, where there's clues all throughout the book. And at the very end of the book, I think it's Inspector Poirot. He's sitting there and he's got all the clues from the whole story and they all work together to come to this answer. So Joseph's story is the denouement of the book of Genesis. So tonight, we're going to do two things. Since I'm saying Joseph's story is the culmination of the whole story of Genesis, for us to feel that impact, we're going to spend a good portion of tonight rewalking through the story of Genesis. It's going to be important to understand some of the themes that Genesis already has going. So we're going to treat this book as a story, and we're going to spend some time on the fact that it's a story, and Joseph's story is extremely important to it, so we're going to spend time in the beginning there, walking through a little bit, and then whatever time we have left, we're going to go through the first part of Joseph's story, which is Genesis 37, when he's sold into slavery. So two things. We're going to walk through the story of Genesis, and then we're going to get to Joseph. Okay? So if we're going to walk through the story of Genesis, let's take it to the very beginning, and we're going to go to Genesis 1. And this is going to be an abbreviated tour of Genesis, but it's going to be important, and I think if you bear with me as we walk through this, you're going to see that many of these stories and many of these themes, they're going to come right back up in Joseph. So if we go to Genesis 1, verse 26 is where we're going to start. And again, for many of you, this is going to be a review, but it's important. So God, in Genesis 1, he's made the world. This is where the Bible starts. God makes the world. He makes the heavens and the earth, it says. He makes the animals, and he makes man, Adam and Eve. And I want to look at Genesis 1, 26, and let's see some things that God says about mankind. It says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them,'" and here's a key word, "'rule. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.'" And then we go down to verse 28. Now another word, "God blessed them." God blessed them, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply." And that's another important word, multiply. "And fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So we got this. The stage is set here. God makes Adam and Eve, and he tells them, "I want you to rule, and I'm going to bless you, and I want you to multiply." Okay? And these are going to be important as we continue. And you know that things start very good. They don't stay good for long. And we get to Genesis 3 now. Genesis 3:14. So God's made the world. He's made mankind. Everything's good. Everything's perfect. The man and woman are living in the garden with God. But then we know the serpent is there. And the serpent tempts Eve and then eventually Adam, and they both fall into sin. And so now we see how God responds to this in verse 14. "The Lord God said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, cursed are you more than all the cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you will go, and dust you will eat all the days of your life.'" And here's the important part for us. "And I will put enmity between you and the woman." Enmity, that word means opposition, hostility. There's going to be hostility now. And the hostility, it says, between you and the woman, in the next verse, and between your seed and her seed. So this is like foundational to an understanding of the Bible, that God makes this promise here, that the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent are going to have hostility. There's a conflict. And when we say seed of the woman, what that basically means, I like Charles Ryrie, he basically says, it's those who are in the family of God. So seed is like your descendants, right? Your lineage. So those who are in the family of God is the seed of the woman, and the seed of the serpent are those spiritual descendants of Satan. This isn't actual snakes, it's the spiritual descendants. But he goes more specific into the next part of the verse and says, he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. So again, there's a conflict here, and we go from seed to an individual, he. One individual. He shall bruise you on the head. So there's one individual who will eventually come who will crush the serpent. Okay, so this is an important kind of grounding here. God makes a promise of a coming deliverer. But we see that there's a warning. He's going to bruise you on the heel. So there's going to be a threat. So there's a promise, and there's a threat to the promise. And I want you to keep that in mind as we go. God makes a promise, but there's a threat to that promise. So we go to the very next chapter, Genesis 4, and I'll just describe it here. Adam and Eve have children. The first two children on the face of the planet, Cain and Abel. This really is astounding. These are the first two humans born. Adam and Eve weren't born. God made them, but Cain and Abel were born. And what happens with Cain and Abel? Right from the jump, we have first two humans. God tells them, bring me an offering. They both bring an offering. Cain's offering is from the ground. It's fruit and things from he harvested. Abel's offering is a sacrifice. It's an animal. And God accepts Abel's, but not Cain's, and Cain becomes jealous because of the favor that God showed Abel. And right off the bat, we immediately see the effects of sin and the fall, because the first two brothers on the face of the planet, one kills the other one. Cain kills Abel. Right from the jump, here's the fall, and here's a threat to God's promise. Because Abel was the promised seed, yet Cain killed him. Right off the bat, we see the promise, and we see the threat. But Adam and Eve have another son, Seth, and he carries the seed along. And if you know the rest of Genesis from chapters 5 through 11, things get worse, way worse. It says mankind was completely evil. God sends the flood and Noah. You think, oh, we're going to restart. Maybe things will be better now. They're not better. And you get to Genesis 11 where mankind now, they're not listening to God. And they're trying to build this tower to make a name for themselves. They don't want God to make a name for them. They want to make a name for themselves. So God scatters the humans. And now you're left wondering, what's going to come of this promise? So I want you to come with me now to Genesis 12 where we'll pick this up. So God has scattered the people on the face of the earth, but now God's going to take one particular man, and that man is the one he's going to give the promise to. He's going to say, I'm going to continue my promise with you. And this man's name is Abram. So chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And that's an important word right there, land. Keep that in mind. And I will make you a great nation. That's also important. A nation, meaning a people. The word that we could use for this is seed. Again, I will make you fruitful. You'll have many descendants. Land, seed. And then he says, and I will bless you. Blessing. Land, seed, and blessing. He says, I will bless you, and I will make your name great, so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you, I will curse. And here's a key part. And in you, Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So Abraham is promised land. There's going to be a particular piece of land I'm going to give you. He's promised seed, descendants. I'm going to make you, Abraham, a great nation. And then he's promised blessing. I'm going to bless you, and anyone else who blesses you, I will bless them. So land, seed, blessing. Okay, so again, God's given a promise. So what do we think follows when God gives a promise? What's going to be the next thing? A threat to the promise. So Genesis 12, verse 10, we immediately see the threat. Now there was a famine in the land. So we have a famine. So the next threat, there's a famine in the land, and Abraham's like, okay, I need to get out of here to get some food. I can't die here. So he goes to Egypt. And in Egypt, he faces another threat, which is violence. He gets there and he thinks Pharaoh is going to kill me. So we know the story, Pastor Bill talked about it this weekend, where he lies about his wife, right, just to escape. But we have promises and we have threats. Promises and threats. And this continues. Genesis 15, God renews his promise. Genesis 17, God renews his promise. We get to Genesis 22. This is like the pinnacle kind of part for Abraham. Genesis 22 is where God tells Abraham, you finally have a son. You waited all these years for a son, and I gave you a son, and now you have to give him back to me. I want you to sacrifice your son to me. This is what God tells Abraham. This seems like a threat right here. Abraham's thinking, wait a second, this is my promised son who's going to be the lineage. He's the seed. I'm supposed to sacrifice him? But this is, we find out this is a test, right? And Abraham passes the test. But I want you to see, once he passes the test, God reiterates his promise to him. Look at verse 15, Genesis 22, 15. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven, and he said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed, I will greatly bless you. And I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And verse 18, in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. I want you to see this theme. Blessings, seed, land. Continually God is reiterating these things. So if you know the story, Abraham has a son Isaac. And look, these promises, we don't have to spend all the time there. They get told to Isaac as well. Isaac, you're the seed. Now from you, I'm promising you, Isaac, land, seed, blessing. We know in Isaac's life, there's another famine. He runs. There's more potential violence from Abimelech. He survives, and he continues on. And now we're going to get to Jacob. So now come with me to Genesis 27. And again, you're probably sitting here thinking, what does this have to do with Joseph? But we're getting there, I promise. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. God promises Jacob's parents, who's Isaac and Rebekah. He says, the younger one is going to rule over the older one. The older one's going to serve the younger one. Meaning, Jacob, who's the younger one, he's going to be the chosen one. But Jacob doesn't go about this in the right way. He doesn't trust God's promise, so he decides, I'm going to do something to get this blessing. So if you know the story of Jacob, he deceives his older brother to get the birthright, and then he deceives his father to get the blessing. So Jacob deceives his own father with the help of his mother to get this blessing, but I want you to see what becomes of this in verse 41. And maybe we can just think about this for a second. You're Esau. You're the older one. You're thinking, I'm the firstborn. I'm supposed to get the blessing. I'm supposed to have the birthright. And yet, my younger brother has usurped me and stolen it. Just think about how you would feel. I can't imagine. But we see in verse 41, here's the threat. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And look, Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, meaning my father's going to die soon. He's old. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. Here it is again. Brother on brother, I'm going to kill my brother. And if Jacob's the promised one and Esau wants to kill him, there's a threat again. Violence within the family even. Promises, threats, promises, threats. And because Jacob goes through all this and deceives his father, he tears their family apart, he has to flee. But God's still working, and we pick it up in Genesis 28, verse 13. And yet again, what's God going to do? He's going to reiterate his promise. He's going to say, I've promised this to Abraham. I promised it to Isaac. And Jacob, I'm promising you still. Look at verse 13 of 28. And behold, the Lord stood above and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. Now notice, the land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Promised land. Then he says, your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, meaning you're going to have a lot of kids. Descendants, seed. Land, seed. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. It's the same thing repeated. Land, seed, blessing. I promise I'm going to do it, is what God is saying. Now the last little set here I want to show y'all is in Genesis 34 and 35. And this, this is a story I think we kind of pass over a lot. It is a kind of horrific story in Genesis 34. Genesis 34, and again, I'm trying to show you everybody that there are common themes in Genesis. It's the theme that God promises things, and then there's threats to the promises. And in Genesis 34, by now, Jacob has grown, and he now has his own family. If you know the way he has his own family, it is quite dysfunctional. He has 12 children with 4 women. And if you know that story, I kind of laugh at this sometimes, though, because if you know me, my mom is one of 12. And so I kind of joke. I say, well, they did it. My grandfather did it with only one woman. So 12 children. And at this point, though, Jacob's children have grown up. He's got 12 sons and one daughter. 12 sons and one daughter. And they're living in this land, and they're near a land called Shechem. And we don't have to read all of it, but I'm just going to explain it. Jacob's daughter, Dinah, she goes exploring in the land. She goes into the land of Shechem, a foreign land, which is not good, dangerous. And while she's there, she gets raped. And it's a terrible story. But what's so crazy about it is the man who does it gets with his family and says, well, I love her. I want to marry her. And so they come to Jacob and his sons are like, you have to be kidding me. What? But the sons devise a plot, and they tell these men, they say, fine, you can marry our sister, and you can marry our daughters when they grow up, and we'll marry your daughters when your daughters grow up, if you all circumcise yourselves. We're circumcised. This is our sign from God. If you want to intermingle with us, you have to circumcise yourselves. And the men say, we can get a lot out of this. Okay, we'll do it. So all the men circumcise themselves. Now, I don't know about you, but I think this would take quite a while to heal, and this would probably be a vulnerable situation. Every man in the city. Well, two of the sons, Simeon and Levi, they have revenge on their minds. They're like, we will not let this act of our sister be unavenged. And you know what they do? They go into that city, and they kill every single man. Every single man they kill. And so what I want to take us to is the end of that in verse 30. Genesis 34, verse 30. Jacob finds out, and here's what Jacob says, the father. He says this. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and Perizzites, and my men being few in number, and they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. And that's important. I and my household. We have to understand, he's got 12 sons, but at this time, there's no police. You don't just call the cops and say, hey, this terrible thing happened. There's no 911. The police in this time are your brothers, your cousins. It's your extended family or any other families you've made an allegiance with. And Jacob's got 12 sons. I mean, that's pretty strong, but compared to the people in these lands, that's nobody. So he's telling his sons, he's like, what have you done? These people are going to wipe us out. So again, what do we see here? A threat. This is a threat to the promise. If the people of the lands come upon them and fall on them and wipe them out, the promise is done. God's promise is gone. But of course, God's not going to let his promise fall. So the last thing I'll show you before we get to Joseph, Genesis 35, verse 9. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram, and he blessed him. And here's what God said to him. Your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Thus he called him Israel. God also said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come forth from you. Here it is again. And this is interesting. And kings shall come from you. That we're going to see that a little bit later. Kings. And then he says, the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. Promises, threats. Promises, threats. I want you to see this, because this is all going to tie together when we get to Jacob. So now let's go to Genesis 37. We're there. I'm sorry, when we get to Joseph's story. Genesis 37. Now, what's interesting, so I've been reiterating these promises, land, seed, and blessing. And God promised them, and we're seeing how they work out. And what's interesting, one of the commentators, John Walton, he said this, the Abraham account, so the parts of Genesis about Abraham, the Abraham account focused on the possession of the land. You remember Pastor Bill told us on Sunday, Abraham went 1,000 miles from his homeland to get to the promised land, the Canaan. And then Jacob's account focuses on the establishment of the family, the seed. Jacob has 12 sons. This isn't a great nation by any means, but this is a beginning. The Joseph story brings the blessing clause into prominence. How is it that God's going to use this crazy family to bless the world? That's what we're going to start seeing here with Joseph. So now we get to Genesis 37, and let's read the first two verses here. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Okay, so the Joseph story, interestingly, begins with Jacob. It begins with his father. And I want you to see in verse 2, these are the records of the generations. That phrase, it's called a toledot. It's a Hebrew word, toledot. And it means the generations of. And Moses, as he's the writer of Genesis, he uses that phrase 10 times in this book. These are the generations of. And that's intentional. It's like dividing the sections of the book up. Well, this is the very last one in the whole book. And what this basically is saying is, let me tell you what happened to this guy and his descendants. What's to come of this guy? So here, when it's talking about the toledot of Jacob, the generations of Jacob, this is significant for us. Because what it's telling us is that Joseph's story is actually not Joseph's story. It's the story of what's to come of Jacob and his family. Like, what's going to come of them? Where are we going with Jacob and his family? So that's how it begins, telling us. The rest of this is actually going to tell us where does Jacob go through this. And so with that, now we get to Joseph in the next verse. We read Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. So I call this section Joseph, the favored son. So we start with Joseph, and we see he's the favored son. He's a young man. He's 17. We see he's a shepherd. And it's important in that first verse there that he's shepherding the flock with sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. These are the two maidservants, with whom his father also had children. So remember, Jacob had 12 sons with 4 women. And these two are 2 of those women who were the maidservants. So Joseph is a son from Rachel, who was the one that Jacob loved most. Rachel was the wife Jacob wanted the whole time. So Jacob wanted Rachel the whole time, but through the crazy things that transpired, these two maidservants also have children. Now, I want you to think, if you were the sons of these maidservants, how would you be feeling? If you come through it from a broken home, you would understand, like, the feeling of siblings from different parents. It's not quite the same. There could be tension. There could be tension with real siblings, but it's not. There could be hostility involved. And so this is ominous that Joseph is with these sons. And it says Joseph brings back a bad report about them to their father. So they're tending their flock, and Joseph comes back to the father, Jacob, and he gives him a bad report. He says, hey, your other sons, they're doing some shady stuff. They're doing some things that you need to know about. And some of the commentators, they're kind of split. Some of them say, oh, is Joseph like just a tattletale? Is he just tattletaling on his brothers? And I could see how you could see that, but I think from the way that the story is written is that that is not the case. His character, as we're going to see throughout this, is so high standards for his integrity that I think actually it's the very opposite. I want you to think, if you're running a business and you got employees, you need employees who you can trust, and especially who will tell you the truth. And you know, if you got these employees and some are acting up, to tell the truth about them would actually take some courage, right? If you're going to tell the truth about some of the things that are going on, you're probably not going to be liked by those other employees. But if you want to run a good business, you need people like that. And so this is the father's business, the sheep. And so I believe that Joseph actually is showing his integrity and his courage through this. So he brings back a bad report. And then in verse 3 it says, now Israel loved Joseph more than all the sons, because he was the son of his old age. Now this is interesting. Jacob loved Joseph more than the other sons. Jacob should know better. Because if you know Jacob's story, his parents had parental favoritism. Jacob's parents were Isaac and Rebekah, and one favored Esau, and one favored Jacob. And that eventually led to the splitting up of the whole family. So now here's Jacob, and he's doing the same thing. He's giving Joseph more favor than his brothers. And then he says, and he made them a vari-colored tunic, the coat of many colors, famous. Now, I don't really want to do this to you, but I kind of have to. The coat of many colors, this is actually quite a debated word. What does it mean? I'm not trying to ruin your Sunday school stories. But it's a difficult Hebrew word to translate, and the translators, they're kind of torn on it. And part of the difficulty is that this word is only used one other time in the whole Bible. The word that's used for vari-colored tunic here, and it's in 2 Samuel 13, describing what one of David's daughters are wearing. And there it's translated long-sleeved garment. And it even goes farther to say this is what the princesses wore. So actually, it's got this connotation of like a royal garment. Like this is more than just your normal clothes. Now, again, they're split, so if you want to just keep coat of many colors, you can keep it. But I'm trying to show this is an important article of clothing here. And again, John Walton, Genesis commentary, he puts it like this. Most commentators favor something more along the lines of a full-length coat or a long-sleeve coat, but either of which indicate that Joseph is in management, not labor. So Joseph's in management, not labor. He's got an elevated position from his brothers. Right, he's actually, you can see, he's bringing this bad report back, so he's got a little bit of leadership among them. And that's going to become important in a minute here. And in verse 4, it says, his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him. And they couldn't speak to him on friendly terms. And another way that translated is they could not speak to him in peace. So sibling rivalry, parental favoritism, they can't even speak to Joseph peaceably. They can't even greet him. Hey, brother. That's how angry they are at this jealousy for the parental favoritism. So we see Joseph is the favored son, and then this is going to escalate into the next verses where we see Joseph's dreams. Let's go into verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I've had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." How do you think these brothers feel right now? Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. I find it interesting. They don't need any interpretation of this dream. He says it, and they know. What are you saying? You think you're going to rule over us, younger brother? You can feel their anger in the way they respond. Now, to make it worse, he has a second dream. So look at verse 9. Now he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." Sun, moon, what do we think these are? His mom and dad. So not just the brothers now, mom and dad. Now look at verse 10. He related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come bow ourselves down to you, to the ground? Shall we bow down?" Now, I think if you had a highlighter, I would highlight bow down in both of these dreams, and I would highlight rule and reign, because guess what? We're going to see these again. These are themes that are going to come back again. And what I think is interesting also, verse 11, his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Jacob kept the saying in mind. He hears that Joseph's having these dreams, and he's keeping this in mind. And you know who this kind of reminds me of later in the New Testament? This kind of reminds me of Mary. When the angel's appearing to her, and it says she kept these things in her mind, or she pondered them in her heart, she's saying, something's going on here. And Jacob, he should understand something. He should understand about God and how God could choose the younger over the older, because that happened to him. And he should also understand that God can reveal things like this in dreams because he did it to him. Jacob's alarm should be going off right now. Wait a second. My 11th out of 12 sons, he's having these mysterious dreams. I already favor him. I've given him the cloak. And now he's having these dreams. His bell should be going off. Here's how Alan Ross, a professor of Old Testament at Beeson Divinity School, he says, "Jacob knew how God works. He was well aware that God could select the younger to rule over the elder, and that God could declare his choice in advance by an oracle or a dream." So the scene is set here. We have a favored son. God seems to be saying, this son's going to rise in prominence. But of course, we're going to see in a moment here that there has to be a threat now. We're going to see the threat. But before we do that, I want to get to verse 12. And 12 through about 17 are interesting. The kind of verses that at your first blush, you could kind of just blow through them and not see anything there. But I want to show you as we go through them briefly here that there's some interesting stuff. Verse 12, "Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel," who's Jacob, "said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them. And he said to him, I will go. Then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron and he came to Shechem." So Jacob, he knows his sons. He knows these ain't good guys. And the sons are off about 50 miles away in Shechem, 50 miles north of where they are in Hebron. And Jacob tells Joseph, one of the youngest ones, go check on your brothers. But this isn't just like go down the street. We're talking 50 miles. And you should also be thinking, it's probably very obvious that these brothers hate Joseph. So is this not kind of a naive thing for Jacob to do? Let me send the young son who they all hate by himself 50 miles away to the brothers who hate him. This just seems like a bad scene. But what I think is interesting is when Jacob says this, you know what Joseph says? I'll go. I'll go. And I think this is, again, revealing to us. Jacob is a faithful son. He's obedient. His father says, I want you to go. And even though it's risky, Joseph says, I'll go. He knows what his father cares about these other sons, and so he goes to check on them. And then in 15, we continue. A man found Joseph, and behold, he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, what are you looking for? He said, I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock. Then the man said, they've moved from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. And again, we see a little bit of God's providence. Joseph's on his own. He's wandering around in the field. He's like looking around, and this man happens to stumble upon him. And this man also happens to know, I know where your brothers went. And he's 50 miles from home. But we should also see his brothers are not where they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be in Shechem. They're not there. Now again, Joseph, he could have easily just gone home right now and told his father, I went to where you told me. They weren't there. And so I'm back. And I think he would have successfully fulfilled the request, right? Go check on your brothers. They weren't there. I came back. But I think what we're seeing here is Joseph cares about his father's heart. He knows his father cares about these sons, and so he's trying, he's going the extra mile, actually extra 15 miles to get to Dothan to really try to find out how are the brothers doing. Joseph cares about his father's heart. But here's what we're going to see now. The brothers do not care about their father's heart. Joseph cares about his father's heart. The brothers do not care. And so the first half of this story is Jacob, the favored son, or Joseph, the favored son. And now the second half is going to be Joseph, the forsaken son. Let's go to verse 18. When they saw him, the brothers, when they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Now then, come let us kill him, throw him in one of the pits, and we'll say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams. So you can feel how ominous this is. Joseph's brothers see him from a distance. They kind of start expressing their anger, like, oh, here comes this dreamer. But that anger takes this sinister turn, and it goes just from anger to, we're going to murder him. We're going to kill him. And, you know, as I was reading this morning, just reading it again, and you know what made me think about is, this is so good. This is Jesus in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, I say to you, you've heard it said, you know, do not murder. He says, but if you have anger in your heart, you are a murderer. And I think this is the perfect example of that. They have this anger in their heart, and what does it do? It turns to murder. They're going to murder their own brother. Let's kill him, throw him in one of the pits. We'll say a beast devoured him. While the previous section showed how people envy faithful chosen servants of the Lord, this section reveals the fruit of that hatred and envy if left unchecked. The brothers tried to get rid of Joseph. It's the Cain and Abel story all over again. This is Cain and Abel right again. This is jealous brother to the favored brother. Let's kill him. So here comes that theme again. And so now what the brothers think, they're going to come up with this plot, and they think, let's see what's going to become of his dreams. I think, personally, that is like a key verse for this entire story. God's given Joseph dreams. And the brothers say, let's see what comes of these dreams. They're going to try to thwart God's plan, but in the midst of them trying to thwart it, you know what's happening? They're playing right into it. They are playing right into God's hand. So let's continue. We're going to see how this goes here in verse 21. But Reuben, so one of the brothers, he heard this and he rescued him out of their hands and said, let's not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Just throw him into this pit that's in the wilderness, but don't lay hands on him. And then it says, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. Now, this is interesting if you know the background. It doesn't really tell us his motives. Reuben's the oldest son, and he's like, let's not kill him, throw him in this pit, and then it says that he's going to rescue him. So it's almost like, put him in the pit, and then when the brothers aren't looking, he'll take him out of the pit and he'll get him back to his father. This is interesting, though, because if he succeeds with this, he's going to gain favor of his father, but isn't he not kind of telling on the other brothers by doing it? He's going to basically be doing the same thing that they hated Joseph for. So he says, throw him in there, and then he's like, I'm going to come get him later, and in verse 23, so it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and they threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. And I think this is so important. You see what Moses does there as he writes this? They stripped him of the tunic, and he goes out of his way to say, the very colored tunic, the coat of many colors. They stripped him of that coat, the one that his father gave him that he loved. And then they throw him into a pit, which is like a cistern, like a hollow cistern. And it says it's dry. There's no water in it. And we learn later on in Genesis, I think 42, Joseph's not just complacent here. He's pleading with them. He's pleading with them. Please don't kill me. You throw me into, I'm going to die of thirst here. He's pleading with them, and I want you to see this. Look at the very next verse. Then they sat down to eat a meal. Look at the heartless. No concern. Absolutely no concern. Now, I like the way one of the, another commentator, he put it like this. Earlier they said, we'll say that a wild beast devoured him. But guess what? By them sitting down to eat this meal heartless, he's basically, the commentator is saying, we know who the real beasts were who were trying to devour him. They're just sitting down to eat a meal like it's nothing. And so it continues on. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. So again, I'd say this is God's providence. These brothers are pretty much set on, we're going to throw him in here, we're going to let him die in this pit. But it just so happens, here come some people caravanning by. And so we see what happens in the next verse, 26. Judah, very important, Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. For he's our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. I wrote this in my Bible. I literally put eye roll. Like, you gotta be kidding me. He's our own brother. Let's not take his life. We don't want his blood on our hands. Let's sell him into slavery. And let's make a profit on it. And so I think Judah is going to be a very important character, and he's going to be in the background for a little bit, but this is setting the scene. We see Judah. He is an opportunistic brother. He sees this opportunity. He's like, well, you know what? Wait, let's not kill him. Let's at least make a little something off of him. You also see he's persuasive. The brothers, they kind of listen to Reuben, but then when Judah brings up a scheme, they're like, yeah, we like his plan better. So we're going to see Judah a little bit more later on. And keep going. His brothers listen to him. Then these Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus, they brought Joseph to Egypt. And I think just the main thing I want to point out here is, notice, they sell him to slavery for 20 shekels of silver. And if you think about this, who else do we know in the Bible who gets sold for some pieces of silver?
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Jesus was sold for the price of a slave. Joseph was sold for the price of a slave. So we have the favored son, and now he's their forsaken son. And now we're going to see that the plot continues. We add some deception into this plot now in verse 29. Now Reuben returns to the pit. And behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. So Reuben must have been elsewhere when this is happening. He wasn't there when they picked him up and sold him. But he gets back, and Joseph's not in the pit, and he's like, oh, you got to be kidding me. And look at verse 30. He returns to his brothers and says, the boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go? Again, who is Reuben concerned about? Me. And the reason is Reuben's the oldest son. So he's thinking, well, number one, so much for me, for my plot and gaining favor with my father. Like, that's ruined. And also, I'm the favored son. This is my responsibility to take care of Joseph. So he knows this is going to fall back on him. The boy's not there. Where am I to go? And then verse 31, so they took Joseph's tunic, same tunic, slaughtered a male goat, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the varicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not. And he examined it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. So Reuben, he comes back, and not only is his little plan foiled, now he gets pulled into this deception. And I find it interesting, because earlier Judah was like, let's not kill him, we don't want to have to cover up his blood. What are they doing right now? Covering up his blood, literally. And I think it's interesting to note that earlier we see that Jacob sends Joseph to the brothers, and the brothers send Joseph's blood-soaked garment back to Jacob. You see how they feel about their father here, huh? Another thing that's very interesting to point out, they're deceiving their father. They're deceiving Jacob with their brother's piece of clothing and with this goat's blood. Now, think about this for a second. These sons are deceiving their father with a garment of their brother and something from a goat. Who does this sound like? Jacob. So their own father did this exact same type of thing to his father. When Jacob was trying to steal the blessing from Esau, he used a piece of Esau's clothing on himself because his father was blind. He couldn't tell, and he was going to feel the clothing. And then they took some skin of a goat and put it on his hair because Esau was a hairy man. So he deceived his own father in this exact same way. And we see here this principle, what you sow, you will reap. So we continue in verse 35. Then all Jacob's sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. So his father wept for him. Again, this is another eye roll moment for me. His sons are now going to comfort him, like, oh, father, we're so sorry. They know. They know. Now, I will point out, though, the text doesn't tell us how they feel. And that's important. We got to be careful about going too far outside the text. It doesn't say how the brothers feel. So I think this leaves it open for us to consider maybe the brothers, when they see the devastation of their father, maybe, just maybe, something changes. We're going to see later on if this is true. Maybe something changes with them, but the text doesn't tell us, so you're left to kind of wonder. But we're also kind of left here wondering, okay, so the favored son, and he's now forsaken. So what's going to become of Joseph? What's going to become of these promises from God? What's going to happen? But thankfully, we get a little clue in verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So I think this meanwhile is significant here. While Jacob and the family are completely distraught, and for all intents and purposes, Jacob literally believes, my son is dead. He's dead. And while this is going on, it says, meanwhile. And to me, this is just God speaking here. He's like, God's still working. They think it's all lost, but God is still working, because Joseph is sold not just to any like normal field slave. He's sold to Potiphar. And Potiphar's a high-ranking man, and Potiphar is close to Pharaoh. This puts Joseph in a very interesting position that we'll pick up on next week. So what I want to leave us here thinking about is Joseph's story is a part of a bigger story, the bigger story of Genesis. And that story is filled with God's promises, and it's filled with threats to the promise. And we see here already in Joseph's story, this kind of promise of a son maybe to rise up is showing itself, and we immediately see the threat from its own brothers. And we see that God has selected a leader, but the threat from hostility of jealous brothers comes to try to foil it, and we're going to pick it up there next week. All right, let me close this out in prayer. Father, thank you for this story. Thank you, number one, that this is not just a fairy tale story. This is a real story, Lord. This really transpired in history. And that's so important to us because when we read this and we see the craziness of this dysfunctional family and we see the wickedness of these brothers and we see how they're trying to foil your plans, we learn nobody can foil your plans, Lord. And we learn that you can use messed up people to accomplish your will. So I pray, Father, that as we continue in this, we would grow in our knowledge of you. We would understand how you work. And through that, we would fall in love with your word. And we would learn to trust you more in our lives as we live day to day, Lord. In your name we pray. Amen.